Welcome to Managing Love Intelligently. I'm Jason.
And I'm Stephen Ng.
Stephen Ng is a licensed marriage and family therapist with over 30 years experience. And I'm a guy who, after multiple relationship failures, is searching for answers. So you hear that, Steve?
I feel the pressure now.
All right. So how this works is I present a topic to Steve, which I've planned ahead of time, but Steve has no idea about, and we talk about it for an hour or so. Today's topic is the fallacy of love conquers all.
Mm.
So I'll let Steve think about that for a second. And before we start, if you have a question for Steve, visit stevieding.com, fill out the contact form, and let us know what you're thinking. And at the end of each episode, Steve will answer a listener question, so stay tuned for that. So to begin, so every so often, Steve will email me links to articles about sex and relationships and things like that. And in one of the recent articles, this idea of the fallacy of love conquers all came up, and I thought it'd be good to chat about it with you.
Yeah. Do you remember who wrote the article or what the context was?
I was looking for it and I could not find it. I think it was some kind of opinion piece where it was kind of deconstructing these ideas, but it was only about 1,000 words or something like that. So it wasn't that intensive. So I was like, maybe we could do an episode on it to kind of get into this, because I feel like it's one of those things that's been around for ever. I mean, it's in songs, it's in movies, it's
poetry from centuries ago. Yeah, absolutely.
And love conquers all. It's almost like and we're talking about managing love intelligently. So it's kind of like, the love conquers all seems it's just about letting love guide everything, and everything's going to work out that way. But I know from my failures, it's like, it doesn't work, because sometimes you could love the person as much as you want, but they will not love you back and they'll leave you. So that right there kind of.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things, it's always nice to be philosophically tolerant and affirming, I think, because there's some truth to it in the sense that, you know, we all have seen people who were going down a very bad path in their life, and then love comes into their life and they turn things around and they become great parents and they become responsible. And that is a possibility, even with sometimes, you know, in the Israeli conflict with Palestinians, there have been incidents where even the Palestinians, Fatah group, was intimidated by some of the terrorists they had trained, and their solution was to get them all married. Mm. And that seemed to settle everybody down. And I think there's a lot to that. But if by love conquering all, we mean I can love him or her into wellness, I can love him or her into sobriety, I can love him or her into no longer being emotionally or physically or spiritually abusive, that would be, I think, a fallacy. That's pretty painful. And strangely, you know, as we were just talking about before the podcast recording began, it's relatively common for people to have a hard time letting go if they still love someone. It's as if they have this irrational belief that they are not free to go until they have absolutely made sure that they've stomped the living shit out of all the love to death, and it doesn't exist at all anymore. And now that we hate each other, we're free to go. Mm. But I think for the more spiritually minded people listening to this show, it would be wonderful if you really say you can love someone, to see when you do see that they're not right for you, or vice versa, to be able to lovingly let go, you know, just to let go with love and move on with your life. Because none of us are looking for, I hope, after listening to some of these podcasts, I hope none of us are looking for a boyfriend or a girlfriend. We're looking for the right boyfriend or the right girlfriend. And there's some pretty fantastic people out there who we can really see the good in, who are not right for us. It doesn't mean they're not going to be right for somebody, but won't, won't, won't. They're just not for you.
Yeah.
So if that's what we mean, then I think love conquering all is really an unfortunately harmful fallacy. Yeah.
Yeah. And how often would you say that you see it in your work? Like, is it something that It comes up a lot.
It's nearly universal, right? I mean, it's almost like a developmental thing. Like we all have, the thing about our development is that as children, we experience the universe, whether we're talking about our home life or the other kids in the neighborhood or whatever it is. Maybe it's daddy's drinking or mommy's yelling. We experience these things and we start developing beliefs around those things. And for a baby, even the baby who experiences every time they cry, somebody comes and picks them up, somebody changes their wet diaper, somebody brings them food when they're hungry. They generalize by thinking, oh, well, it's a good universe that is really kind and safe for me to grow up in. And in a contrary manner, the kid who grows up with substandard care learns the opposite, that it's a harsh, unloving place, it's dangerous, and it's every baby for himself out there. So then when do we change those beliefs that we acquire? Well, typically, none of us change until the pain gets bad enough. So if I grow up being taught, and usually it's through the culture, right, through the ether in the air and the songs and all the rest, that the most important thing is love. And if you really love somebody, then you should stay with them. And you're really not free to go because you still really care. Well, that person isn't going to question that until they've had, you know, the universe really stomp on their toes a few times, really make life miserable for them. And unfortunately, if we don't learn the lesson soon enough, what we eventually learn is cynicism, that there is no such thing as love. Love is stupid. Love is for losers. And that's not true either. It's just that we need to be able to make that transition from childish thinking to adult thinking. And that, if I haven't already talked long enough, I can go on a little farther. That doesn't begin until we begin self-doubt and embracing the humility that says, you know, I'm really open to being wrong. I've been wrong so many times before. I think I can be open to listening to a new take on this.
Do you feel like that's a lot of what's holding people back? Like their inability to say that to themselves?
Yeah, because it's what it means is letting go of a cherished belief you've held your entire life, even if you acquired that belief at 2 or 3 or 4 years of age. Mm-hmm. And now you're seriously going to question that. And maybe it's a belief of an older age, like 7 to 12, that you've acquired. Like my client who was told that if you're gay, you can't be a Christian. If you're Christian, you can't be gay. And that if you're gay, you're going to hell. And so he knew that he was a Christian and he knew he could not be gay. That's just logic, except it really isn't logic. And what he ended up doing with his life is growing older, masturbating, thinking about boys at school, and then getting older still and marrying a woman from church. But he was never heterosexual. He was never into women. So he was always thinking about guys when he would be with his wife, sexually, that is. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate because really great guy. It's just that he had such a devil of a time getting away from those irrational beliefs. And in a similar way, like you've talked openly about some of your failings. And I try to talk openly about my own because I want it to be safe for the listeners to just really question themselves and be open to a different take on life. But I know for me, it was my identity was based on something like having all the answers. And
this is when you were like an adolescent.
Even before I hit my teens, but certainly through my teens and into my 20s, and it didn't really change until I started going to Al-Anon, which is for friends and family of alcoholics, at around 30. Mm. And at 30 years of age, I'm really questioning everything. And it was a very confusing time. It was confusing for the people who knew me because it was like, what Steve am I getting today? you know, who, what does he stand for? Who is he? And, you know, how we mock politicians who change their views by calling them flip-floppers. Mm-hmm. I think we do something similar with people who are just growing and going through the normal transitions from childish thinking to more rational thinking, and to say, yeah, well, you know, you don't have any integrity. You're not standing up for what you believe. Well, no, I'm reevaluating what I believe, and I'm reevaluating what would be making sense. So this particular myth is just so very harmful, right?
Because what brought you to this, really quick? What brought you to those, or what brought you to challenge those beliefs that you've held on to since you were a kid at 30?
Well, you
was
know,
it Al-Anon specifically.
No, it wasn't that experience. You know, it was pain, and I had that through the. But I also had a friend. The circumstance was I had a friend who is a recovering alcoholic, and he sensed that I had some needs and I would benefit from going to some 12-step groups. And so he invited me along, and I thought, well, to humor him, I'm going to go along. And I thought,
in the back of your mind, you're like, this guy.
Yeah, it's not for me. It's just I'm doing him a favor.
All right.
Which is a good trick to try to, you know, help people, is get them to think they're doing you a favor.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would go, and it took me, I think, probably only maybe 5 or 6 Al-Anon meetings before I realized, oh, this is about me.
And then what was your process for that? I'm just trying to like understand the psychology behind like what was going on. Were you like freaking out in your head?
No, it was just very sobering.
Oh, it was sobering.
Yeah, I was like, oh my goodness, this is really serious. It would be like making light of a situation and then all of a sudden realizing the extreme severity that you're dealing with and how really mistaken I had been.
You didn't feel overwhelmed or be like, wow, I've been living a lie my whole life, or I've been living in this way that...
I did not feel overwhelmed. It did not create a crisis. It did create some insufferable behavior. Like, you know, we've all, I think, heard the jokes about the no one being worse than the new convert. You know, his zeal. He's just anxious to tell everybody everything about whatever it is he's been converted to. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was really learning about dysfunctional families and the impact that has on our lives and what early childhood trauma can do to people and how that affects us in our behaviors as adults, including our mates that we pick out. And I found myself just in awe of this vast body of knowledge that was so genuinely easily accessible. It wasn't like you had to go to college or you had to have a really high IQ to understand, but it was so self-evident that there was really no resisting it.
Okay.
You know, once you accepted certain facts, like, well, yeah, I did think my mom drank too much and I really did feel uncomfortable under these circumstances. Yeah, I guess my dad was physically violent. And, you know, and I get more and more into it coming out of my own denial. But I think, again, it's so hard to change some of our beliefs because we haven't actually been challenged on that specific belief and we don't have enough pain yet. So in my forensic counseling work, I work with a lot of people who are convicted of very serious crimes, including sex crimes, and they have an exercise where they have to list 25 of their irrational beliefs. 25? And I said, don't be joking with me like that, because I've had hundreds of irrational beliefs. If you can't think of 25, believe me, there's a lot of help out there for you. And then they have to think of the rational remedy. But, you know, that if I love her enough, she'll change. And if I just keep loving her, then we'll have a good marriage. Or, you know, if I keep being the loving person, then people will forgive me and see the good in me. Or, you know, and there's like all this magical thinking that comes with really... It's like carrying a lucky rabbit's foot. If I just always have my lucky rabbit's foot in my pocket, then I'm going to win the game. Mm-hmm. Where there's no, between the premise starting with if and the conclusion starting with then, there's actually no causal or logical link. So if I'm really nice to my abuser, then they will love me, or then they will feel love themselves. really, what's the magical leap there? How do you get from there to there? Mm-hmm. And there is no logic that would explain that, and there's no causal force that would cause such a change. So, surprise, it often doesn't happen that way. And then when it does happen, we take credit for it, not in that relationship perhaps, but in any relationship where it did happen, we would maybe take credit for it. Or hearing about somebody else telling a story where the missionaries were at risk of being eaten by the cannibals, but then it was that love that just changed everything, and they didn't get eaten by cannibals, at least not all of them. And I think we cling to these anecdotal myths because they are the proof that proves our irrational belief is actually very rational, and it's very powerful. When in fact, no, the fallacy there is, well, it's called post hoc ergo propter hoc, after this, therefore because of this. And I'm reminded of one of Whoopi Goldberg's movies, and I can't remember the name of it now, but she plays a college student who needs some money. She gets a job as a housekeeper, I think, for this single guy. His wife's died of cancer, and he has a little girl. So she's kind of a governess, mm-hmm. as well as a maid, and kind of gal Friday for him. And he's a very, very good employer, but he's a very damaged man. And she has a little girl in this beautiful old car, because it's set in the 50s. It's a convertible. And she's driving through town, and they come up to a stoplight, and Whoopi Goldberg whistles. And the light changes to green. The girl, her eyes roll over to Whoopi Goldberg. And because I think they were even talking about magic. It's been a while since I've seen this movie. And Whoopi Goldberg whistles at every intersection, and the lights keep changing to green. Now, of course, you and I know the lights were synchronized, but the little girl didn't know that. And this was a little girl who'd lost her mother to cancer, and she'd been told, there is no God, there are no angels, there's no magic in the world. It's a grim, grim place that you've been born into. And her father was trying to be honest with her, but he also robbed her of the capacity for comfort and for wonder and for joy. So for Whoopi Goldberg to do the whistling trick was just a little bit of magic that had her just beside herself, the little girl beside herself with joy. And it just felt great to watch that. Well, those kinds of irrational beliefs, like Santa's going to come and he's going to bring you a present, or the Easter Bunny is going to put out hard cash in those plastic Easter eggs. I know you lost a tooth, but the tooth fairy is coming to put some money under your pillow. Well, for a little child who's capable of believing in those sorts of myths, it's comforting and it's very distracting. And so they're not as upset as they were before. And I can see the utility of it. But that kind of magical thinking, when it accompanies us into an adult relationship, is just so pathetically naive and weak, truly, truly limp. Oh my gosh. Because we think, if I do this magic thing, if I say, I just love you so much enough, then she's no longer going to be abusive, or he's going to stop being the way he is, or surely he'll stop drinking once our child is born.
But it's love. It's like, it's love, Steve. It's like, don't you understand this is part of love?
Well, and I love love. I'm a big fan of love. I love falling in love. I love my family and my friends. And I think love is the cement that binds a social species like ours together. Sometimes the scientists call it altruism. But I think it's a pretty fantastic thing to experience, but it is a real thing, not a magical thing. So, I mean, the magic that it does is more metaphorical than it is, actually magical. So,
but this is I just feel like so many people stay in relationships because of love, or they say it's love, or love's going to conquer all, or they can't leave because they're in love. It's like all this stuff surrounding love, but it's more so.
Yeah, I think
it's like love may be there, but they're not doing anything.
Well, besides being the therapist who's a big downer on this podcast, I also want to suggest there is a, I think what's going on is the resistance to learning some new things. And the new thing would be managing love intelligently. Mm-hmm. You know, that love is pretty fantastic, but it's like everything else in life, it is greatly assisted by the addition of a reasonable amount of intelligence. So yeah, I'm never going to marry somebody I don't love. I think that would be really sad. And I've seen plenty of couples who've done that, but I, because they thought it was smart or this is the right choice or the thing I should do or something like that. But that doesn't really work either. Love is a necessary but insufficient condition for a successful relationship. So we want love, but it just ain't enough. And so, yeah, I want sobriety too in my partner. And I want my partner to be able to be a true adult and not some child masquerading around in an adult body. And I'm sure most intelligent partners would want the same of me, and to have a safe, respectful relationship, not an abusive relationship. Mm-hmm. And we can have it all. That's the cool thing about this. If we build it, we can have all of it. And if we don't get all of it, that love is starting to look a little thin a few years into the relationship. Mm-hmm. It's not really as wonderful as it seemed like it was at first without things like respect, sobriety, compatibility, and so on.
What is your thought on a soulmate, I guess, because it's kind of similar within the vein of what we're talking about as far as love conquers all, or like a soulmate, like this is a person that's meant for me. And if somebody does have that idea where, you know, I can't leave them, they're my soulmate, or, you know, because I feel like people do that, right?
People do talk like that. And it's unfortunate, you know, I think for me, that word soulmate probably means something slightly different in the sense that, well, it's a term I would award somebody like my wife after many years of being together, and we're so in sync with each other and so loving and accepting of one another that I just feel so lucky. I feel so fortunate. So to have met someone like her and to have shared my life, that she is my, not only my mate, but we have such a close connection. The word soul seems to fit in there. But if by soulmate we mean there's this one synchronized person out there in the universe and only that one who could ever be with you happily or soulfully, I think that that's ridiculous. Mm. You know, none of us are so very complicated that we're unsuitable for anyone on the planet but this one person. Because when there were such a, I mean, if you just think about the demographics, we have 8 billion people on the planet now, and there was a time when we had less than a million. Does that mean that when we had less than a million or less than 10,000 humans on the planet, there were all those soulmates were just kind of concentrated in the tribes around us? Mm-hmm. And it just seems rather silly to think that way. When, if you think of yourself as a loving person, I think what that means is you'll see what's lovable about a lot of different people. And if you're fortunate enough to meet other loving people, some of them, not all of them by any means, but some of them are going to see what's really lovable about you. Mm-hmm. And there'll be a minority of those groups that will also have compatibility and that will also be able to enjoy mental health and sobriety and share the same goals and values, you know, going forward, at least for the most part. So yeah, the word soulmate just doesn't seem to have much practical value, but the word love, I think, has a lot of practical value, because the way we bandy it about, you know, sometimes it's very misleading. But I love you, said the person who was treating you so horribly just minutes ago.
Yeah.
You know, but I love you. You know, you can't leave me, or I could never leave him because he loves me, or even though he just put me in the hospital last week.
Yeah.
You know, it's like.
But people look past that stuff too because of love.
Yeah. You get a pass if you use the magic incantation, including the word love, in a sentence. And I think No, to really love somebody, you have to kind of at least like them.
But does it sometimes, maybe that means that is love sometimes for some people where they abuse you.
Yeah, I would reject that. In fact, I guess the response I would have, could you as an individual please love me less? I would appreciate that so much if this is what the word love means to you. Because I not only do I want a heartfelt emotional connection where they can say, but I do love you. And if I could believe that, okay. But I also want loving behaviors like respect, kindness, consideration, all of that. So saying I love you is such an easy cop-out, isn't it? It really isn't legit in the sense of being the real deal.
Yeah.
So, but it can be. I mean, it can be an expression of the real deal. It's just not always. And there are those people who out there who fake it, who will say things like, I love you. When I was just talking to somebody else who, gosh, a client of mine just yesterday said this. She said, she's had men come up to her after knowing her for a week, maybe two at the outside, and saying, I love you.
Oh.
Yeah. And I started laughing, and she did too. And I think we both shared the same perception that absolutely impossible, makes no sense whatsoever. He cannot love somebody he doesn't even know.
Yeah.
And after a week of not living together, but a week of just seeing each other a time or two and talking on the phone, maybe a handful of times, yes, he loves me. Mm. Well, I would argue, well, he loves the parts of you perhaps that he sees, or equally possible, he is just a bullshitter who lies and lies and lies, including lying to himself.
Yeah. What about the idea of, I wrote, again, this isn't a universal thing, but instead of love conquers all, I was thinking love imprisons all.
Oh, thank God. I thought you were going to say love impregnates all.
No. Well, I think, and again, that's not like to be like that's the truth, but I think like if you look at the divorce rate and you look at the amount of unhappy relationships or the amount of dysfunction, and not only, I don't know, just like a lot of romances seemed like they're fraught with issues, and then you're kind of imprisoned by that, and you're imprisoned by love.
Right. But and then the individual becomes cynical, and they don't want to have a thing to do with love because they tried that and didn't get anywhere. And, you know, maybe they've tried it multiple times and they've been hurt multiple times that they don't even want to deal with it. And I've met so many people who have lost all faith in the human capacity for love. And that, you know, it's heartbreaking when you meet people like that. But part of that is their own naivete. And I say this even though some of the individuals who think that way are far more brilliant than I ever could dream of being. It's just they weren't particularly emotionally intelligent. Mm-hmm. So, you know, having advanced degrees or an IQ that's 5 standard deviations above the average, That alone isn't enough to put together a loving relationship. That's a whole different skill set. And it involves emotional intelligence and specific intimacy skills like mate selection, the ability to confront, intentional interviewing, how to set boundaries, how to defend boundaries, how to terminate relationships that really aren't working for you. So that you can go on and develop better relationships. Oh, and taking a look at where you're meeting people. Mm-hmm. You know, I have 2 of the worst places in the world to meet people, I think, are bars. Well, I got 3 actually. Bars, dating apps, and church. I think those would be the 3 worst places to be meeting a mate because it's so very trite. You know, it's a meme where, of course, I'm going to be meeting people. But that's like saying the parking lot would be a great place to be meeting people to marry because you're going to run into all kinds of interesting people in a parking lot.
Yeah.
Well, you are, but – and it's true that
some people – you got to pick the right parking lot.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Whole Foods or Walmart or
right.
Target.
Is it Whole Foods or is it Walmart? Pick yeah. Pick your demographic. I think, you know, it's just – we we have such a dearth of knowledge about managing love intelligently that we cling to some of these irrational beliefs, some of these folksy sayings, some love conquers all you need is love, as if that's what passes for wisdom. Mm-hmm. And it's really not particularly sophisticated. I mean, in fact, it's quite the opposite.
Yeah.
So I just think, I remember being criticized by one prospect quite some years ago, and she said, "Why are you always thinking? It's like you always are thinking about things." Mm-hmm. And I said to her, "Well, because I've come to realize that life goes much better with thinking than without thinking." And I think the same is true of love. I think love goes much better with thinking rather than without thinking. But now, you know, a corollary here would be because love conquers all. And if that, a corollary to that irrational belief would be, well, if you love somebody, then you have to be with them. Mm. When, and I've talked to so many men who resist saying the words, the three most beautiful words, I think, in the English language, "I love you." They resist saying those words because they think those words, if they say them to a woman, spell the equivalent of making a commitment.
Like a forever commitment.
Yeah, that you're the one, I'm in, and I'm all in. And so I don't think that's true. I think, again, those who have fallen in love in the past are going to be able to fall in love in the future, most likely. And the ones who fall in love, and just as it didn't work out in the past, it often doesn't work out in the future. So we have to hold it loosely and enjoy the experience. I'm not saying reject it, but holding it loosely doesn't mean denying it. And it doesn't mean slow pitching it. To be able to say, "God, I really love you." I think it's such a wonderful thing to say to somebody, but it's not the same thing as saying, "And I want to be going steady," or "I want to move in together," or "I want to start, you know, having one checking account between the two of us."
When you talk about holding it loosely too, I get what you're saying, and I've been practicing that myself. But I also think, like, how do people get to that state to where they're able to even do that? Cause it's like a neediness thing, right?
You're right. And I think when you're extremely needy, it's like the starving man who's clutching the donated food to his chest. You know, he doesn't want anybody to steal it from him. Mm-hmm. When we're particularly needy, we're grasping and we are very stiff in holding on to what we've got. When in fact, love is just one of those things that there is no controlling, and to accept that and to accept that, you know, she or he may have been fond of the other person for a moment, but they moved on, and or they revealed themselves to be something you're really not comfortable with, like say a cigarette smoker, something that's not particularly significant, but it's so potentially irksome to non-smokers that they might as well have said, "And I'm the worst person who's ever lived, and here's the proof."
Yeah,
you know, I think whatever the occasion is, it doesn't mean I didn't love them or that I don't still love them, but I can let go and smile and say it kindly that, yeah, I'm not the right guy for you. And to be okay with that because, oh yeah, there's another 8 billion people out there waiting.
But do you ever feel bad when you said that? Like, I think I might've asked you that before.
Or like it just made them cry.
Like it made them cry. Horrible man.
Well, to say I'm not the right guy, I don't think I'm the right guy for you, I think is something of a gift, right?
Did it take you a little bit to get to that point, or did you feel like?
No, once I learned that line, I used it all the time because it was really helpful. You know, it's ultimately a kindness. You're being very disclosing and vulnerable and quite often I've had women argue with me, "No, I think you'd be great for me."
Yeah.
And then I would point out something, "Well, I think you deserve a guy who's absolutely crazy about you. And I just don't have those feelings for you." Or, "You deserve the kind of guy who just can't wait to take you into his arms and kiss you. And I don't ever feel that way about you."
Wow. And you would just say that straight up.
Well, yeah, I think so, because I've been told that my feelings are normal and feelings are okay, and yeah. It's okay to have feelings.
But well, it feels so bad. Like I've in my dating life, it's like it's very hard. It feels bad, but I think I had to look at some of those people pleasing tendencies and codependency issues and kind of work past them, and to say to myself, feelings are okay. It's okay to feel this way and have feelings. But it feels for me very off-putting.
Yeah.
Like it feels like I'm, and sometimes when I talk to people who maybe are more people pleasers and stuff like that, they like look at you like, I don't know. Love's love, you know, like some people will say, like, love's love, and some people believe this, like, love conquers all stuff. So it's like, if you're dealing with people like that, if you're talking to them about it or telling them a situation, you could feel kind of bad about yourself, or,
you know, but it sounds like you're saying that if she wants me in her life, I'm really not free to go until she's done with me.
Mm. Okay.
I mean, let's move on.
No, I'm joking.
Well, like, I don't have any right to any agency here, and
no, yeah, I hear you on that. Yeah, but
is that what it is? Come on,
I mean, it's a hard situation, like some of these, like, because like the one, like one situation I'm in currently, it's like I said all the stuff I needed to say, but then still trying to be friends throughout that whole thing, and like trying to navigate that and let that go. But I know you just kind of, when you cut stuff off, you cut it off, or they didn't want to talk to you ever again. And it's,
well, yeah, I'm really open to being on friendly terms. And mm-hmm. If I broke up with somebody I actually care about, then yeah, I'd love to continue on with some sort of a friendly, kind, loving relationship. But I haven't found a lot of takers.
Okay.
On that offer.
So that's okay then to have that done.
If you can pull that off, I mean, more power to you. I think you should start a podcast. Seriously, that would say something wonderful about the kind of women that I think wonderful to me, at least, about mm-hmm. the kind of women you've been hanging out with.
Yeah.
But if she's really not, if you're really not the right woman, right man for her, if you're not the right man for her and you let her know that, I just don't see how guilt can be a part of that unless you have the irrational belief that you somehow are responsible for her feelings.
Yeah, I think I'm still working through that one, probably. Or, yeah, have a little bit of that.
Well, we were talking about early childhood and that period of time when we accumulate our irrational, I mean, we have the minds of children, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not surprising we have childish beliefs. And for me, I grew up with a very loving, doting mom who was conflicted in a lot of ways because of her alcohol use, but she was just someone I never wanted to hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up with her as a template for women in general. I just didn't want to hurt them. But the irrational thing was I presumed I had the power to inflict emotional pain.
Yeah.
And I really don't have any control over women and their feelings, just as they don't have control over mine, just as none of us have control over anyone else's feelings. So it's true that a man or woman might be disappointed to see someone not reciprocate in the feelings that they had been hoping for. But I think the gift is they were honest and they moved on and they set you free. And now you're free to go find someone, hopefully, who does reciprocate those kinds of feelings. And in the long run, isn't that so much better than somebody stringing you along because they couldn't hurt your feelings?
Well, yeah, that's what it feels like to me. Like, it's like, if I can't do this for this person and I do genuinely care about them, I don't want to continue dragging it on or making them think it's going to be something else. And it's better just to say the thing that you need to say. And
yeah, especially when you're made aware of it. Mm-hmm. And that's why I really, for people who really hate breaking up and have a really hard time facing that moment, I would encourage people to not make commitments until they've done a lot more data collection, because I think we all owe it to ourselves to date a lot of people and learn a lot more about, number one, what does the world have to offer? And number two, what is it that I really need? Mm-hmm. Because this world is so full of absolutely amazing, wonderful people. And there are enough horrible people in it that none of us would want to be with them. But, you know, if we think, well, but she loves me and I don't dare leave, mm-hmm. because what will I get then? It's not like this happens to me all the time. And
yeah.
And so.
And those are all irrational beliefs too.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, it's kind of ironic that the very act of being honest and forthright and saying, this isn't really working for me. I really don't have the kind of feelings for you that I think you deserve. And I care about you. And I'd like you to have somebody who's really crazy about you in your life. I think every woman deserves that. Don't you, Susan? Mm-hmm. And Susan nods her head tearfully and everything. So, but I think in the act of being able to, in the process of being able to say something like that, you become a better man. Mm-hmm. And you're that much more prepared for that right person who's truly more compatible with you.
Yeah. Man, I was thinking about, myself too, like going back to the thing with the controlling other people's feelings. I definitely think it's probably stuff like growing up with like my parents and stuff. And again, because a lot of stuff stems from childhood.
So absolutely. You know, like getting punished because you made your mom sad.
Yeah. And stuff like that. Or it's like kind of my parents reacting their ways. And it's just kind of, and then when you see it, it's easy to kind of like let it go and become aware of it. For the most part, it's unless someone is really holding on to things.
Well, you know, it's funny because here's the process I've noticed, and I know a lot of listeners are going to relate to this. My brain can see it. My brain can see the rational thinking and the irrationality of, you know, my childish thinking. But in the meantime, my heart is kind of, you know, stroking its chin, and it's not buying it. Mm-hmm. Because for my heart, these truths represent a lifetime of accumulated wisdom. Mm. And for my heart, it has that truthy feel Jon Stewart talks about. It just feels so truthy that I can't give up thinking I must be able to influence people's feelings. I must be able to control them a little bit. Mm. But if you go through the exercises, all the thought experiments, you realize, no, you never did. It was all an illusion all along. And that, you know, that you're just another soul out there hoping somebody likes you in a way that works and that you like them in a way that works. And then hopefully you both have a life worth living so that you can, in fact, have a life worth sharing. And then it's like, that's when the music happens, you know? So mm-hmm. one of the crazy things, again, if you were going to be cruel to me and promote some irrational thoughts that just drive me nuts, it would be that, well, marriage is, you know, hard work, Steve. And I've heard it said many times, marriage is hard work.
Yeah.
Relationships take a lot of work. And I think that that's absolutely untrue. I think getting to a point in my life as an adult where I'm rational and I'm capable of loving without game playing and all the rest, well, then relationships are super easy and almost to the point of being effortless, and you're walking around in wonder. Really? Was it always this easy? Well, yeah. Of course not. When we were children, we were struggling with childish beliefs and childish needs. But if you do your work and you get yourself ready and you have a life worth living, you've set aside some of the mental health challenges like codependency or alcohol abuse or some of the other more common ones. You've overcome whatever tendencies like mine to be depressed. Well, then, yeah, relationships are going to be really easy if you get together with another person who's equally healthy.
Yeah. That's something that I've been thinking about a lot too. And I thought you said that it was perfect how you said that. What about the belief about, I've had some people say, well, the highs are highs and the lows are lows. Like I had one friend who would say that all the time.
Oh, is this the same friend who said he needs a little crazy?
No, a different one.
Oh, you've got some crazy friends. Yeah. So, yeah, for me, the only thing I can relate that to is, you know, being in a really awful relationship and living from mountaintop experience to mountaintop experience with these months and months and months of deep valleys in between where, you know, I'd hit the mountaintop and I go, wow, we're really having a breakthrough. This is great. We finally figured it out. And I would milk that experience for months of deprivation and unhappiness afterwards. And then just as I was about to give up, there'd be another mountaintop experience. Yes, here we go. And now looking back, I have to just laugh, shake my head at myself because it's like so foolish. But I didn't, you know, I think the reason I persisted in my magical thinking is because I didn't have any other thinking to replace it with. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't like people around me were having conversations about managing love intelligently. That wasn't a part of my growing up years.
Yeah, mine either. And my friend who would say this was one of those people who thought he knew everything about everything. And I remember though hearing that and like my heart doing the chin stroke and being like, I don't know if that's it's necessarily
really
the best thing.
You really think so?
Yeah. What about happy wife is happy that means happy life?
Yeah, I think, you know, some of us.
No, I'm just like thinking of all these sayings.
But, yeah, these sayings.
You but know, they are fun to pick apart. And
they are. About. I think for me, I love my wife, and my wife has quoted that saying to me. And there's a certain truth to it because it does. I feel happy when my wife is happy, and I enjoy that. But I also feel happy when she's unhappy for the right reasons. So it isn't really a law or even a rational statement. It's just sort of a fun, quirky little saying that we say. But the darker view of it would be, you know, in some families, there's a patriarchy. And basically that men are the true citizens of the realm.
Yeah, that's like, just watched that documentary, Shiny Happy People. Have you seen that?
It scares me. Yeah, I've seen parts of it. It just really scares me. And there's a lot of that in even the current TV show, Shogun, where we're seeing how, you know, there's a patriarchy and women are not really valued in the same way at all as men are. But it's also possible for human beings to flip the script and go right over to matriarchy. And so I'm not a fan of either approach. Because I think, especially in this modern age, it's very clear. I think it always was clear, but I think it's very clear now that really equality is the name of the game.
Yeah.
Because two heads really are better than one. And women have always been as smart as men, maybe in different ways, maybe with different aptitudes. My wife and I, we're not smart in the same ways exactly, but I think my life would be immeasurably impoverished without her input. And so if I were part of a patriarchal school of thought, I think I'd be missing out on a huge blessing in knowing her. And this, but the same is true in reverse.
Because it does kind of like make it so you can't know the other person if you're above them, because you can only know them in what they cook for you, what they clean for you.
Yeah, as a subservient or as an employee or as a child or as a pet. And it's the same way with matriarchy, where and I see this all the time, where it's just that patriarchy, because I think women are so articulate and compared to men, that we hear a lot about the evils of patriarchy, but there are many, many relationships that I see in my office where it's very matriarchal at its core. And it's very difficult. You know, it's one of the reasons men lie, isn't it? They're afraid of getting in trouble.
Yeah.
And so whether it's getting in trouble because he hurt her feelings, getting in trouble because he disappointed her, getting in trouble because he didn't measure up to her standards of what righteousness was or whatever it was that she was looking for, the good enough man. All of that is smacks of matriarchy to me. And it's sort of a, you know, what is it? The iron fist and the velvet glove. So it may seem a little bit nicer, but it's still very controlling.
Yeah. So then to wrap up with the fallacy of love conquers all, you would like, what advice would you give for people? For me, I mean, I've kind of had that fallacy. I've grew up with it, and it's really helped, again, not to pitch the podcast or say, but working with you and reading other books and just becoming more aware of how I go about relationships has really helped me see that it's not just this idea alone.
You know, I think that, and by the way, I appreciate the positive feedback. Thank you. I think for me, what I said earlier is true. It's just that it's so rare for any of us, like in groups of men, to have an intelligent conversation about love, or for men and women who are dating to have an intelligent conversation about love, or for parents with their children to have an intelligent conversation about love, or in sex education to have an intelligent conversation. There is no venue where that's happening.
Yeah.
It's just not happening. So when you and I met and we started talking about these things, I can't think of a more delightful topic. I love talking about this because it seems like such an important thing to figure out in life. Mm-hmm. It's like right up there with career. You know, if I have no idea what to do with myself as in terms of career, that's a terrible thing for any young person. Mm-hmm. But to have no idea how to have a meaningful, intelligent conversation about love, much less actually have meaningful connections with others, it's just so disabling. And in the end, it's very destructive to us. And I say that as somebody I think in my life now, I could easily be single the rest of my life. God forbid something happened to my wife, but but it's partly after knowing her and being with her that I can say that, because I've checked a very big box in my life. Mm-hmm. Oh, I know what love is. I know how great it is to be with somebody in a loving, caring relationship, and not just for a minute or a year, but for now going on 30 years. And it's been, oh, so fun and so sexy and so loving and kind and spiritually growthful. I wish everybody could have that. Mm. But as important as that subject matter is, we don't seem to find anybody who's willing to talk about it.
Yeah.
And I think that's why we started this podcast, right?
Yeah.
Is to begin talking about it. And I'm just so grateful that you and I are starting to get really comfortable talking about this stuff, because I think it's such a, and again, I don't like to be self-promoting either. I really just squirm with discomfort. But I think it's very important for people to figure out. And I hope this podcast helps people with that.
Yeah. Great. So to end, we have a listener question. And if you have a question for Steve, visit steveding.com and fill out the contact form. And this week we have a short question. So it's as follows. Hi, Steve. What is your opinion on so-called, in quotes, emotional affairs? Is it really cheating if there is no physical contact? Go.
Okay. Just want to remind the audience, I've never heard these questions before you did. So, no, I don't think it is infidelity at all. I do think it's a symptom of maybe something missing in my life. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that my mate is doing something wrong. It's something missing in my life. Mm-hmm. So an emotional affair would be where I'm truly fallen in love with the other person, and I'm looking for more and more opportunities to legitimately and justifiably hang out with her, like at work perhaps, or at a coffee that's in the daytime in a public place. But I'm just eating it up like I'm just with the biggest crush of my life. And maybe I don't think that that's an affair. I don't think it's reasonable to talk about, but it's something. It is something. I just don't think it's an affair. And what does it mean in my life? Depends on the life, right? It depends on what's going on in our lives. But I would argue with anybody who thinks that it's all evil, because I think sometimes it's just a reflection of, again, the fact that loving people see what is loving about a wide variety of people. So I can I love two people at the same time? Yeah, absolutely. Because I'm getting all my needs met and I'm perfectly content in my marriage. But do I still have enough heart to be able to love someone else and see what's lovable about them? Absolutely. Mm. And what if they were just an amazing person? Could my emotions grow and grow? Yeah, of course. Absolutely. But I have taken some countermeasures to make sure I don't get into any drama. And I think that's really the concern, I think, for the other spouse, is they just don't want any drama. It's not that you and I might have feelings for somebody else, but to have firmly turned the flirt switch to the off position, to being perfectly open about how attractive you think they are and why, what is attractive about it, you know, like her courage, or I really admire her sense of humor, you know, or it's so insightful, or whatever it else that her earnestness and sincerity just really moves me. You know, I've just seen so many wonderful people in this world. And when it comes to men, as a therapist, I'm supposed to be quite cognizant of what we call countertransference, where I'm projecting onto my clients my own feelings. But the truth is, I meet so many great men out there I would love to be friends with. I meet them and I have to remind myself, yeah, absolutely, we cannot go out for coffee. We cannot become friends. It would destroy the therapeutic relationship. They're not looking for a friend. They came to my office looking for a counselor, and that's what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. But it's the same with, and when I say these are men like I really admire and I think are some of the finest men I've ever met who come into my office, and it's the same thing is true with the women who come into my office. I can admire them and think they're just amazing. But again, it's a professional relationship and I've turned the switch to the off position and we go forward and we do therapy. But that doesn't mean I don't have feelings. Mm-hmm. So I let the feelings come in me and through me and experience them. And then I let them run through me and go on into the universe. And I think we can all do that in our marriages, in our relationships.
But let me give you a little context on it. Just for a thought experiment. What if it was like you're married in a relationship and you're having you're talking to this person online through like some sort of social media app and maybe through text, and it's like going on for a consistent amount of time. Is that something?
Yeah, it's time for me to spend a little more time with my wife. Okay. You know,
it's just like the short term. It's okay to be emotional, be open, be real with people. And
I do think it's okay to be emotional and to be real. I think it's okay. And at all times, I would say it's okay for me to be cognizant of my feelings. But if I'm finding myself on social media spending, or even on a telephone call, spending regular time because I'm just really enjoying them the way a man enjoys a woman. Mm-hmm. I think that's a warning sign to me that, you know, something, I need to do something about this, either realize how amazing my own life is and get back to that, mm-hmm. which includes my great wife, or to let go of that, because, you know, there are certain people in this world, and I think of some of the wonderful borderlines out there, people struggling with borderline personality disorder, they have such a disarming way of ingratiating themselves into our lives that it's very compelling. All of a sudden, we feel very close to this person when we actually haven't done the legwork to actually have earned any kind of closeness. It just feels so fantastic. And that's something I think for all of us to be aware of. And then, of course, there are the manipulative people who are just so incredibly flattering, you know, who could flatter the happiest of married people out there into some sort of a bit of a flutter where they're getting excited and really pleased. And maybe it's, maybe I'm particularly vulnerable to that because my mate doesn't compliment me ever, or maybe my mate doesn't ever share the extravagant love that's in her heart. I'm not in that kind of a relationship, so I'm pretty bulletproof to that stuff.
Yeah. But you wouldn't call it an emotional affair, though, or you would, or
no, I don't think it's particularly helpful terminology. Mm-hmm. And I think it's somewhat stigmatizing. It's over sexualizing it, I think, in an unhelpful way. I'm not opposed to making a generalization or using a metaphor if it's helpful. I just don't find that particular one very helpful.
Got it. All right, cool. Well, thank you very much for the question, and thanks for chatting, Steve. It was great chatting with you as always.
Same here.
All right, see y'all later.